Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference 2023, April 23rd through the 28th, Nashville, Tennessee. The Gaylord at Opry, what a center, what a place. We have amazing speakers, amazing training, five of the most impactful days of your career. Check it out at streetcop.com. You do not want to miss out. There is a room code available for a discounted room. Sign up now at streetcop.com.
111.
You trying to be a street cop? I was out there recently for the first time. Jersey.
Very nice. I like Jersey.
Yeah, yeah. Have you been to Jersey?
I've been to Wildwood. That's where my neighbor's from.
Wait, so you've actually been to Wildwood?
Yeah.
It's a weird take on Jersey because it's not really that Jersey-ish if you really want to experience Jersey.
Oh, okay. Well, then I have to go experience Jersey because I've never experienced Jersey then.
Yeah, your teeth are perfect for Jersey. You fit right in.
You're funny.
So I don't think there's any reason to just go into an intro. We're just rolling as it is. It's typically what fucking happens on my podcast.
Wait, so how long have you been on the job?
I actually retired as well on an injury 7 years ago. So I would have been my 22nd year this year, but I got a job when I was 19. I know you got a job when you were like 8 or something, right?
No, I mean, I was actually an explorer. I was an explorer, cadet, parking checker, water conservation officer, community service officer, college police officer, and then Santa Monica police officer. So
and how
I was
old were you?
20 and a half.
Yeah, I was 19 in the academy.
Yeah, see. So yeah, but it was, I knew what I wanted to do. My dad and my uncle were both cops. They both were cops in Santa Monica also. My uncle died of cancer, so I never met him. And then my dad got killed when I was 12. And
holy, he was actually shit. Retired. Yeah. How did he get killed?
They're not sure. They think he was set up, but he was killed in Santa Monica. He got a call in the middle of the night on my sister's birthday, and he wasn't feeling well that day. And next thing you know, he gets this phone call, gets up out of bed, puts his gun on, you know, takes a shower, puts his gun on and his suit. He was also PI. So after he retired from the police force, he became a PI. So they're not sure if this was related to him being a cop or him being a PI. So next thing you know, he goes to this bar down the street, which is probably a block away from my grandmother's house. And this is like a dive bar, not a place that he would go to. And supposedly the owner said he went there for coffee. There's no freaking way my dad went there for coffee. And the waitress later on told my mom that the owner had told my dad to come in the next day because he had information for him. And that was the night before. And so she thinks that the owner set him up. So, and basically what happened was two guys came in the bar. One guy stays outside. The security guard from the bar asked my dad if he can help escort two drunk guys out of the bar. So my dad, of course, with the police mentality, takes them out. They go outside. The car with the two guys, the one that went inside later on, you find I was talking to the owner. The other one who was standing near the car pulls out a gun, shoots my father in the chest. My father had a chance to shoot one round. The two guys he was with, the drunk guys, they were shot. And then the security guard ran for cover and didn't have bullets in his gun. So after that, they claimed they couldn't find the guy. Some years later, a year later, the owner burnt down his own bar. And I think because he knew they're just basically hammering the place. And then we find out later on that a guy confessed to killing my father in a Mexican prison. And so he wanted to get out of the Mexican prison. So I heard the tape recording of that. It sounded so almost like directed. So it wasn't like this guy confessed. It was like he wanted to confess because he wanted to get out of prison. They think he was a drug user and that the drug dealer pretty much told him pretty much take the rap. So next thing you know, a year later, he dies because he escaped prison. A year later, he dies in L.A. And so, yeah, and they claim that, that was enough to prove that this guy killed my dad. And that was it to close the case. I'm like, no, that is not enough. I found out more shit on the street when I was a cop. Because people would come up to me and say, hey, we know who killed your father. We know, like all these different things. And I'm like, there's so much more. You guys are just like basically closing up like no big deal. Yeah. So that's how I became a cop. Because I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Okay. What year was that?
That was in 83. So I was only 12.
So in 83, your father, when did he retire from the police department?
I want to say in 76, retired.
So is this like a mob thing, you think? Because that's when the mob was very prevalent.
I don't know. Well, my dad was writing a book about the Mexican mafia and police corruption, which my mom got rid of that manifesto a long time ago. But, who knows what was in that? And I was so young, I didn't know about that until later on. I'm like, Mom, why'd you rip that up? And she's like, I don't want it near the house. I don't want to even look at it because who knows what it could have brought to our house. And she was, I didn't want to get more in danger. So, yeah, I don't know what it could have been related to.
How did that impact you at 12 years old? And how many brothers and sisters do you have?
Well, my mom was pregnant at the time. And I have two half sisters from my dad's previous marriage. And then there was two older sisters, but one died before I was born. And then I had two younger sisters and one brother. So, and the youngest one was the one that was my mom was pregnant with. So all I remember is that day that the police came, which was my dad's friend and a family priest. I just remember the car rolling up to our house, and I remember the door opening and them telling my mom, you know, Lou's dead, and my mom collapsing in their arms. And it was just devastating. I just felt like something just stabbed me. I was like, I felt like it was a nightmare. So now I remember that day like it was yesterday.
What was your relationship like with your father?
I was close. I was very close to my dad. Yeah. I mean, I definitely wanted to follow in his footsteps, and I knew that's what I wanted to do.
So you honored him by going into police work?
Yes.
Yeah, I am very close with all. I have four children. I'm very close with all of them. They're little though. They're just little folks.
How old are they?
8, 6, 5, and 2.5.
Oh, how cute! Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, yeah. Awesome. So, I can relate in a weird reverse way to how you feel. What's your ethnicity? What's your background?
My mom's from Guadalajara, Mexico, and then my dad's background is from Spain.
Yeah, interesting, because you look Italian.
I know, I get everything.
All right, so your first significant incident, how long were you on the job in 1996, right? You're hit by a drunk driver?
Yeah, so it wasn't even my call. It was someone else's. I get on the call. We're following this girl. We basically block her in. I remember going to her driver's side window. My car was parked at an angle in front of hers. There was another car parked in the other angle on the other side. And then so all the officers were basically swarming her car. And I remember asking her, roll down your window. And she wouldn't. And she's just looking at me with like this glazed look. And I said, roll down your window. We're going to break your window. And at that point, she sees them about to break the window. She rolls it down. Well, when she rolls it down, I put my arm in. I open the door. When I opened the door, she had the car still in drive, but her foot was on the brake. So she still had her seatbelt on. So when the officers basically went in to go grab her, and I'm on the other side of the door, the front of the door, they grab her. And she's now still not going anywhere because she's in the seatbelt. She punches it. So when she punches it, now her door pushes me between the police car and her car. So now I'm basically being pushed between her car and the police car. And I'm trying to hold myself up. And I'm like, I'm going to pop. I'm going to totally pop. Because like my whole pelvic area, my knees, wow. I was like, I am going to die right here. And I'm looking at her and I'm like, I'm going to shoot you. Like I'm trying to go for my gun. And she's looking me dead in my eye. And I'm like, I'm going to freaking die. Well, she at that point veered away from me and the police car. When I felt the release on my pelvic area, I immediately just threw myself in front of on top of the hood of the police car and rolled in front of the police car. She took off and they pursued her. She crashed and they caught her. And you know, she was on drugs and psychologically just unstable, just a mess. And my whole pelvic area was black and blue. My knees pretty much were like, we're going one way and my back, you know, so I was very lucky. I didn't break anything. At first they thought I had a hairline fracture to my knee. Unfortunately, I don't know if in the future, because I've had two miscarriages. I don't know if being hit by that car caused my miscarriages, you know, or could have, you know, been the cause of my miscarriages. But, you know, I didn't try to get pregnant when I was on the job. I got pregnant, you know, later on when I got retired. So
that's the first significant instance. How long were you on the job at that point? It's 96.
I started in 93, 94, like 90. I was like 2 years on the job at Santa Monica. So, and I remember I was so quick to wanting to get back to work. I just wasn't even thinking about it. I was like, no, I got to get back. So I didn't want to be known as, oh, one of those officers that milks it. You know, it's like, no, I got to get back on the job. And looking back now, it's like, I realized I should have taken the time to recover because my knees are a mess. My back is a mess. I have so many injuries, that I tell officers now, stop being that person that, you know, is going to worry about what everyone else says. You got to worry about yourself. You got to take care of yourself and, you know, like you're your own advocate. So if you're injured, you know, take the time to recover. You know, just do what you got to do to be your best. So
what were some of the things you experienced as a female police officer in the early 90s?
I mean, I didn't have any bad experiences on the job. What's funny is I feel like I have more bad experiences when I got shot and when I left the job, and just with people, the way they talk afterwards, because now you're not there, or they talk behind your back, or, you know, unfortunately, when I got shot on the job, I got shot in 2000 on 4th of July. It was a hostage situation and it wasn't even my call. And I get there and, it was myself and some other officers that got there after the other initial officers, and they caught the first guy. And what happened was the situation was two guys were wanted for murder. They were out of San Bernardino. Their phone calls, it was traced to our Santa Monica pier. And next thing you know, we get the description of these two guys on our pier wanted for murder. So the officers get there, they show up, they caught the first guy, had an altercation with him. He dropped some bullets. So next, you know, when I get there, some other officers get there. My sergeant tells myself and this other officer, a female officer, okay, you two watch the bullets. And then you to all these other probationers and everyone else, you guys go with me. And I'm like looking at her going, what the hell? Why are we watching the bullets? Like, you know, this is bullshit. And so we're just standing there and I'm hearing everything. And I'm hearing the guys probably in the back of the arcade. And it's this guy that's bald and tattooed, which describes everyone on that pier that night. And so all of a sudden I'm standing there. My old partner shows up and he's like, hey, Christina, can you help me cover the back? And I look around and I see another officer. I'm like, hey, can you cover these bullets? So the female officer I'm with, she's like, what the hell? She's so pissed. And so the other officer's like, yeah, I'll take care of it. So now I take off with my partner, my old partner, and we go to the back of the arcade. Well, we had no idea what, you know, what was going on, because the guy was actually coming out of the arcade. He was basically with the hostage, and I never saw him. And what happened was the officers that were in the back of the arcade, they were retreating. So I just see, a bunch of people in front of us, a big crowd. All of a sudden I hear bullets being like whizzing by us. And I'm like, oh crap. Cause we're running into the crowd. And as we're running into the crowd, literally I'm feeling these bullets whiz by my head. And I'm like, where the hell is this guy? I don't even see him. And he was aiming at all the uniforms. So he knew exactly where we were. And next thing I know, I feel something hit my arm and it fractured my humerus, shattered my radius. Whoa. But at the time, I'm like, oh, it's just a graze. My adrenaline was pumping so much. Like, oh, it's just a graze. I didn't even call it out. I don't even remember thinking I called it out. My partner's like, Christina, you've been hit. I'm like, no, I'm okay. He's like, no, look at your arm. And it's just hanging. I'm Whoa. Like, okay, can I? Yeah. But I'm right-handed. So, it was my left arm. And so I still had my gun in my hand. I'm like, no, I'm okay. I'm okay. He's like, no, we got to get out of here. And at that point, another officer comes up, the female officer. And now she's basically trying to put pressure on my arm. We end up jumping in the back of a police car. The guy's still shooting. So dispatch is basically putting out, officers down, basically whatever they're still broadcasting. The paramedics weren't even on the pier because they couldn't get down there because there was an active shooting. And so my sergeant, the one that told me initially to watch the bullets, he now is the one taking me to the hospital. So he's like yelling at me, like, why didn't you stay with the bullets? I'm like, too late now. I mean, at the point I wasn't thinking about it. And so now we're rushing up to UCLA and they weren't even ready for us at the hospital. Because our dispatchers were busy broadcasting everything on the pier. So next thing I'm walking out of the police car and I lost so much blood, but I don't remember seeing any, which is really weird. As we're walking in, I see my cousin and she's a candy striper. And I look at her. I'm like, you look really pale. And at that point I pass out.
Whoa.
I think I was the one that was just losing everything. I'm like, yeah. And so next, I wake up, they gave me 2 doses of morphine. I just remember being on the gurney and just waiting for my mom to show up and everybody, cause I didn't cry. I just want to make sure my mom didn't see me cry, cause she's already had that door knock before. So I didn't want to worry her. So she shows up and luckily she did, because the doctor told her they were going to take my arm. Oh, and when, and so my mom's like, no, if you can save it, save it, even if she's not going to be able to use it. So thank God they listened to her. When I woke up, I was partially paralyzed in my hand, couldn't open it or close it. I couldn't straighten it. And so I was in the hospital for a week. While I was in the hospital, I mean, I know I had a lot of visitors, but I was so out of it because of the morphine. At that point, I remember, being in the hospital for a week, but when I got out of the hospital, it wasn't like how it is now. It's very different. Like everyone would have been out there, taking, greeting you when you get out. I had nobody. I just walked out of the hospital with my mom, went in my car and then went home. And I lived in Santa Monica. So my apartment was in Santa Monica. I had 2 visitors that came to my house during the whole time I was going through my rehab. Wow. And I was going through a lot. I went through a lot during that whole time. My mom and I weren't talking at the time because she had an issue with my ex-fiance at the time. My grandfather had passed away. I was supposed to get married that year before. And my ex-fiance had called off the wedding a month before the wedding. But I still stayed with him. So my mom did not like him. So she's like, if he's calling up the wedding, why are you even with him? I'm like, it has nothing to do with the wedding. We're just going to work on the relationship. So between that, I'm sitting in my house thinking, okay, I'm not talking to my mom. Don't know if I'm going to get married, not being able to use my arm. Not sure if I was going to go back to work or not. I mean, I had so much going on and I remember just sitting there and no one came to visit, so I didn't have that
support system.
Yes, exactly. And so as I'm sitting there, I'm like, why am I here? I mean, not that I would ever kill myself, because I'm not that person, because I totally believe in God and I believe he saved me for a reason. But I remember sitting there going, why am I here? Like, I don't want to be here. Like, if I can't use my arm, if I can't go back to work, like I was just a mess. And I remember sitting there and I had my Bible on my coffee table. And what's funny is I never have my Bible on my coffee table. It's always in my room. And I'm sitting there, I'm looking at this thing, and I'm like, God, really, why am I here? And all of a sudden I look at that Bible and I remember picking it up. And I don't remember all scriptures. I'm so bad at all that. But I will never forget this one. It was Jeremiah 29:11. And basically it was about God has a plan for you. And pretty much like not for you to understand right now, but one day you will kind of thing. Like, I don't know exactly the verbiage. But then I went to the next page and it was, God's not going to give you more than you can handle. This too shall pass. It was like, I felt like God was talking to me. Every time I turned to something, I'm like, okay, God, I got it. And so at that point, I remember saying, you know, no, all this negative stuff, I'm going to turn into positive. I remember just praying on it. And I remember at that point, I started going to Bible study retreats, women retreats. I was working out. I went to the gym twice a day. Like, I was going to gym at 2 a.m. And I had a contraption on my arm. It looked like Freddy Krueger. I mean, I'll have to send you a picture, but it was like this thing that was like this cast with the these things, little cranes that would hold my fingers open. It looked awful. I mean, I swear I looked like a monster. So I'd go at the gym at 2 a.m. when no one is there, and I'd be on the treadmill and I'd be just like working out and doing all sorts of weird things. And within July to Thanksgiving, I opened my hand. And within a year and a month from when I got shot, I went back to work full time. And the only thing I can't do, they can't supinate or pronate, like rotate my wrist all the way, and I can't touch my shoulder. But I was able to manipulate the shotgun and rifle differently. I was able to do push-ups and pull-ups. Just had to work everything differently because I, you know, can't move certain things. So, but yeah, I went back to work and gave them another 8 years. And between those 8 years and 2006, I was on Survivor. Because of everything that I went through, and that was an interesting experience. I wasn't planning on doing that, but because of that, now I do a bunch of charity events and I try to raise, you know, awareness in a lot of different reasons for different things.
So you did retire from Santa Monica Police Department?
Yes. In 2008.
What, on a medical injury? Did you medically retire?
Yes. So basically my arm, cause I've had, numbness in my left arm. Cause I also had carpal and cubital tunnel surgeries, which they thought that's what I had, but later on, they ended up finding out it was my neck and my back. Well, my neck that's causing my arms to get numb or whatever. And so when I was having numbness in my left arm, my hand, they pretty much procrastinated me seeing the doctor. So they used up like my 40 or 50 time. And that's the time that the state time, or whatever. And so I wasn't able to stay on the job. If I were to stay on the job, I wouldn't get paid. So I'm like, no, how am I going to pay my bills? So at that point, I was forced to retire. And then at that point, now I've been fighting them since 2008 to now to basically get any of my benefits. Cause even though you have future medical, it's a joke. They deny everything, delay everything. And you're basically fighting for all your benefits. And so it's been a process. I mean, I had, like I said, pay for my own neck and back surgery initially. And now I need another neck and back surgery because of course, once you do one disc, the other disc above and below will start deteriorating. So, but I believe everything happens for a reason. It really does.
What do you say to somebody? And I brought this up in one of my courses on Monday in Minneapolis area. I tried to explain to these guys the importance of safety. This has nothing to do with your thing, but I'm going to get to where you can chime in. You know, taking this job as seriously as they possibly can and really spending time and investing into their tactics and things that could save their life. We had a guy in the class who was actually shot through the chest with a 7.62 rifle round.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And he actually, luckily enough, did not hit any organs. It went in his chest and out his back.
Oh my God.
He's a young guy. And he didn't hit any organs. So he's like, oddly, like crazily enough, I'm okay. But I said to him, I go, why don't you tell everybody in this room how much it hurts to go through something like that? Like, and he's like, oh, it's pretty bad. And I'm like, bro, like, let's elaborate a little bit on that.
Exactly. Don't downplay it.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe you can convey to people what kind of pain you were in and what kind of pain you are continue to be in.
I mean, one thing I will say, when I went through the shooting or even went in the car accident, when your adrenaline's moving, you know, it's flowing, everything's going, you don't feel a lot of pain. It's almost like you feel it, but it's more of a temporary thing. And then when your adrenaline goes away, that pain is like 10 times more excruciating. When I felt that bullet hit my arm and went through my arm, it felt like someone hit me with a baseball bat, full force. At the time, my adrenaline was pumping more because the guy's still shooting. So my adrenaline's just really on fire. And so I didn't feel like, I thought I'd be okay because I was just like, I'm good. You know, like mentally and thought, I'm thinking it's just a graze. But when I got to the hospital and before they gave me that morphine, that pain was like, oh my God, like I couldn't move that arm. I couldn't touch that arm. I didn't want anyone to touch that arm. It was that bad. And now, I mean, with all my injuries, I mean, if your injuries don't heal properly, you're going to have residual pain. You're going to have the back pain. You're going to have the knee pain. You're going to have the neck pain. You're going to have the, like right now, I feel like I have arthritis sometimes in my left arm, or my elbow will kind of lock where I have this, the screw, that screw they put in there. And I don't think that people understand. It's like almost like constant, like someone's snapping rubber bands in those areas, or just the bees are attacking you. Like when I was getting my nerve back, luckily I was feeling this, but you feel like bees are stinging you, or you're getting stabbed in your arm from the nerves, or the nerves are coming regenerating. So it's awful. It feels like your arm's on fire, but people don't understand that extent, because, you know, as myself or you or anyone else, when we go through things, we want to downplay things. We want to act like, oh, everything's fine. We can handle this. And we don't want to bother somebody else. We don't want to ask for help, or we don't want to inconvenience somebody or complain about everything. But realistically, there's times I remember just crying at home with no one around going, this is bullshit. Like, I shouldn't be dealing with this. Like, you know, like I don't know. It gets overwhelming. And even now things get overwhelming, because when you can't do certain things and you need help and you don't have the help, it gets overwhelming.
I think people in their minds think there's some kind of romance associated with being shot.
No.
And yeah. Can you just, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, like I've been back with what you were saying about being a female officer. When I got shot, I remember my scar, the first thing the doctor asked me, he's like, you know, we're going to make sure your scar is behind your arm. Is that okay? I'm like, yes. He goes, I know you're female. You're probably going to want your scar hidden. I'm like, yeah, I definitely do. You know, please, whatever you can do, just disguise it. Well, most guys probably would want it. And I'm like, you know, whoever's into that wants scars, wants them noticeable. I didn't. And one thing I will say, after I got shot, when I went back on the job, and I worked so hard to get back, and I remember having dreams about going back to work and stuff, and that I was going to get my arm. I remember when I finally went back, I didn't have that welcome greeting that I thought I was going to get. It was a very quiet, very almost like as if I was on vacation kind of a greeting when I got back. And I remember talking to one of the records clerks. She saw me, and I was always upbeat. I was always a very optimistic, happy-go-lucky person. She comes up to me and she's like, Christina, I noticed that you're not really yourself. And she goes, but I just want to let you know, don't let these guys discourage you. She goes, these guys are jealous that you were, you're an officer, a female officer, that was in a situation, you were shot, you got injured, you know, you recovered, and you came back. They don't have that story. You do. So there's going to be a little bit of jealousy or animosity behind that. I'm like, why? Do they not understand? It's not like I just broke my arm. It's like I went through being like partially paralyzed to being told I was never going back to work to, you know, like, do they not understand? It's like, I would never wish this on anybody. And the fact that, like, why would they, like, get mad? Like, I just didn't understand. I couldn't comprehend it. And then the stories I would hear that they would say about, and they weren't even there. Oh yeah, she ran into it. She was out in the open. Or I'm like, how's that bad? Like, I'm going into the crowd trying to find this asshole, and next thing you know, he's shooting, and I have no idea where he's at. How's that bad on me? Like, if I knew where he was at, then I would have got cover. But I didn't, and I was still going through the crowd trying to make sure none of these people get hurt. So how's that bad? And they changed that year. It's so funny. They changed the Medal of Valor to Medal of Being Injured in Line of Duty that year. So they downplayed it. So I'm sitting there going, are you freaking kidding me? And I'm like, okay, you know what? Like, my medal is in my closet in a box somewhere. I don't have it up. I have nothing of my police stuff up, because it really discouraged me of how sickening, like, they, when I looked at my, how it was red, pretty much it was like as if they went in and recovered me. I just sat there going, okay, you know what? They can believe what they want to believe. I was there. I wasn't that out of it. I would know what happened, but certain things happened. Certain people said certain things that they did. And I just, you know, I'll leave it at that. So, and that was discouraging. It really was. And it's sad because they don't, if I was a guy by now, I'd be probably praised. I'm like, oh, good job, Christina. Thanks for coming back. You know, like, you'd be praised for your guy. For a girl, for some reason, it was a totally different welcoming.
Have you made peace with that yet?
You know, it's funny. I go to the police department and I see some of the guys. And now there's a lot of guys I totally respect that totally respect me. And then there are ones that I know are just, I look at them, I'll say hello, and I don't say anything to them. I don't ever confront them about it. But I just realized, you know, at this point in my life, I try not to worry about the past. I try not to worry about what people think, because they're not paying my bills. They're not going through what I'm going through. And one day, you know, heaven forbid, they're going through what I went through. And then they'll understand, it seems like, because it seems like you have to be in someone's shoes to understand what their difficulties that they're going through in their life. And if they're not, then they are so easy to be that Monday morning quarterback and talk about everything else. But I made a little bit of peace. I mean, I really don't go to the police department. And it's funny because I was born and raised around that area. I was born and raised in Santa Monica. It was like my second home. And now I just feel awkward going there, you know, because I feel like I don't feel like I'm part of that.
When you said they probably don't know what it was like because they haven't spent a moment in your shoes. This is truly a skill known as compassion. How have you learned about compassion going through what you went through versus what you knew about compassion before?
I've actually met a bunch of officers. Every time I see someone get injured on a job and I see them on Instagram or Facebook, I always try to reach out to them because I know that they're going through what I'm going through, what I've been through. And I relate to them, can relate to them. But I also know, like, in fact, Polly, the one you've met, Polly, him and I met actually through Instagram, and we spoke about his injury because his injury is very similar to mine. And we ended up becoming best friends. Him and I can relate. But other people, I mean, if I was a cop now and I wasn't injured, now knowing now what I've been through, and I wish, you know, like I, back when I was a cop, I wish I was one of those officers that would go and reach out to those officers who were injured a lot more. I wish I'd be, hey, what do you need? Because, you know, like I didn't know all this stuff I was going through. I thought, oh, they got people helping them. They have someone, a supervisor going to their house. No, it's not like that at all. Once you get injured, it's pretty much like you're left on your own. And they'll call you whenever they want you for something, or they'll call you whenever they want to, you know, make sure you're at your house or whatever. But it's not really about you and looking at your best interest, looking if you need someone to help you with a burst of pipe or, you know, a bad roof or something, or even taking out the trash. They're quick to take pictures of you taking out the trash because work comp, you know, there's also work comp fraud out there, but they're so quick to take pictures of that, but they don't realize even if you're injured, you got to take out your trash, especially if you're living by yourself. And I wasn't married at the time. I was living by myself. I had to do a lot of things by myself with one arm. I would tell officers now, if they're on the job and they've never been injured, have compassion, go and help those officers out, go reach out to them because you have no idea what they're going through mentally. You know, not only physically, but mentally, because a lot of them have other issues going on, whether maybe they broke up with somebody while they're going through their injury, or having financial problems, or even having addictions to some of the medications they're on. Because, you know, when it comes to work comp, they're so quick to give you that medication, you know, the pain meds and all that to cover the massive problem, but they don't want to deal with it. But there's all these issues happening, and mental health is a big thing. I mean, more officers are killing themselves day by day than getting killed in line of duty. And I think people need to open up their eyes because a lot of it is because of injuries they have on the job or things they've seen on the job. And we got to stop that. And I think that every officer out there, whether injured or not, to start, you know, paying attention and start helping other officers that are going through stuff. And if they don't hear from somebody, reach out, go do a door knock on their house, you know, just kind of check on them because they're not going to ask for help. I mean, even when I was going through my stuff, I never asked for help. I didn't want somebody, you know, go out of my way and call somebody and say, hey, can you help me take out my trash? Hey, can you help me do? No, that wasn't me. I will do whatever I can and do stuff on my own because I'm just not that person to ask.
There's an interesting thing that I practice that when I think of somebody who probably wants to hear from me or anybody, I just call them. That's it. I just stop what I'm doing. I just call them. I go, hey, how you doing? How's everything? How you feeling? Even if it's for 30, 40 seconds. Actually, there's a lot for me. So I don't feel the guilt. And I also secretly like to do things for other people. That's like my jam. So weirdly enough, it's actually more of a selfish thing, but in some weird way. But I know it means a lot for people to be at least just asked how you're doing. And
yes.
I don't think it has to be a physical injury. I think it'd be something mental that people are going through as well that you know that they're facing and or maybe even loneliness.
Yes.
So
no, there's a lot of things. I have friends of mine who I've seen going through so many things and you know, I'll be talking to them and you could hear it in their voice. You could hear certain things happening. And you know, I'm always asking here, how are you doing? Let's get together. Let's go for dinner. And I'm like, I'm going to pick you up. But if people don't reach out, they're going to get even lonelier. And one thing about officers, when they get injured on the job and they leave the job, not by their choice, they have an identity crisis. They wonder where they fit in, what, you know, like, because their whole life was being a cop. And all of a sudden now they're going to be injured, be in a situation where they don't have their camaraderie, they don't have the connections with the public anymore. It's not the same anymore. Everything's very different. And now they're looking for another career in their life when they were so focused on that for their whole life. So it's a lot going on. And I think that's where people start becoming very mentally unstable because now they go to drugs or alcohol or other things to kind of mind alter, you know, their feelings. So
numb the pain.
Yes.
It's a very quick fix to try to resolve anxieties and depressions, and it does make you feel better. I'm just fortunate enough where I have not had to turn to substances, essentially. And I think that Well, let me go back a little bit. Earlier, you talked about a Bible verse and you said, this too shall pass. What do you tell somebody having been through a very difficult time in your life, not only physically, but mentally? What do you say to somebody now who may feel hopeless, feel like it's never going to end, like the world hasn't given them a break yet? What do you say to somebody, as somebody who's been through something, Christina? What's the advice you have for them now?
Well, if someone has been through something, whether traumatic, tragic, you know, hopelessness, everything that you possibly could that can go bad, and they don't know what else to do, I always tell them, you know what? Like that saying, this too shall pass. In this moment, we're going through so much and we feel like it's the end of the world. And we feel like there's no end to it. Like in the sense of like, okay, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. I tell them that it's always going to change. What we're dealing with today is not going to be what we're dealing with tomorrow or not what we're going to be dealing with next year. It'll be totally different. And we're going to look back like, wow, it was so bad during that time. Like, you know, if anyone wishes they were dead during that time, like, wow, thank God I didn't do something because now things are great. You know, things are going much better. I can look at things differently. I mean, but they have to have that period where they have to find solutions. I think there's a solution to every problem. And I don't think suicide is a solution. I think it's a permanent decision that is, you know, you can't change. So I always tell people, no, you're going to go through something, but there's always something. If it's finances, we'll get you some financial help. If it's, you know, an addiction, well, we'll get you help there too. You can go get rehab. If it's about relationships, well, okay, if it's a guy or girl, there's plenty of other guys and girls out there. You know, everyone thinks at the end of the world because they think that one person is the love of their life and they're never going to find somebody else. No, there's always something better out there. We just got to open our eyes instead of being in this box and kind of like looking tunnel vision. No, there's a lot more out there. We just got to open our eyes to it and just be like, okay, be patient. And even though it's a suffering right now, there's going to be something better at the end of this whole thing. And I have plenty of my friends who are going through so much right now. And I tell them, like, stop, don't stress about things. Things are going to get better. One thing I will get mad at, and you hear this thin blue line all the time, and we're a family. Well, it's convenient when it's convenient. When people are going through their struggles or going through addictions or going through whatever you want to be, the hard times, a lot of us officers don't want to be around that. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to be in like a toxic environment. So they pull themselves away from that. And they don't really help that person. They rather stay away from that person, which is not making things any better. You know, we need to find solutions for these officers going through any of those hardships and tell them, okay, if they're going through financial problems, well, I know there's plenty of nonprofits who always say that they're going to be out there to help those officers. But realistically, when you go to them, there's all these little details, like little fine lines. Oh, no, well, if you're not tragically, you know, if you weren't shot, then you're not going to get this. Or if you weren't, like, no, it doesn't matter if you're shot. It doesn't matter if you're whatever. If you got injured on the job, you got injured on the job. Help those people. If they have an injury where they can't recover from it right now and it's causing a financial loss to them and, you know, they can't pay a mortgage payment or something, well, then let's do something to make sure that they get that mortgage payment taken care of, that they can deal with their injuries and not worry about that stress. So that one little stress to you and I might be nothing, but to them, it might be everything. And then that might cause them to, you know, commit suicide. So I think that there needs to be more nonprofits that if they're out there and that's what they say they're doing, then to do it, because we really need to reach out to these officers going through whatever, you know, struggles they're going through, mental or physical, because it can become even more mental than the physical part of it. And then that's where we have the losses.
When you were going through tough times, do you remember the moment when the tides turned a little bit for you and things started getting a little bit better?
Yes. Well, that day, that's after I read that Bible verse or Bible verses. I mean, like I said, I told myself all my negative stuff that I'm dealing with between my ex-fiance, because I remember him coming over to my house and saying, okay, what's going on? I go, well, what's going on? Are we going to get married or not? He's like, I don't know. I'm like, well, I do know. There's the door. We're not getting married. I'm not wasting any more time with you. And then with my mom and I weren't talking. She like pretty much disowned me for that year because her own issues and stuff like that. And we had a little altercation at the hospital. And so she wasn't talking to me. And that was very hard not having my mom support me during that time. But I still continued to go in her house, still gave her hugs, even though she kind of ignored me. For me, having support from the church, because I was going to church, I was going to women retreats, I was going to Bible study, focusing on all the good stuff, focusing on like hearing stories like Job in the Bible, which is he had all these things going after him and things couldn't, he thought things couldn't get worse, but they kept getting worse, but he overcame them. I feel like I was a Job during the time I was going through my stuff. But I realized I had to have a different mindset. And I think if you change your mindset and start putting things out that are positive or like manifesting, saying, no, this is not as bad as I want. Like, I'm not going to let this bad control my life. I'm going to make it better. I'm going to find a solution to these problems. For me, I knew that I wanted to go back to work, whether a doctor told me I couldn't. And I had, like, you know, Curlin and Job telling me I was not going back. I had all these well-known doctors. And I'm like, nope, I'm going back. And I remember praying. I'm like, God, you made me. I know you can fix me. And I remember I was determined. I literally was going to massages, rehabilitation. I was going to, like I said, the gym twice a day. I was running. When I was, my arm thing, it went from the whole full arm to, like, I went down to my elbow and then down to my wrist. And it basically was like, I was making it smaller and smaller. And then when I did a relay race with my cousin, she was an FBI agent, or she still is. We did a scorpion run, and it's a relay race. And I ran with this little contraption on my arm still, because I couldn't open my hand. And that's when I felt those needles, like the stinging, because my nerves are regenerating. And I tell people, if they're like, I told Polly, you need to start running. You need to start making that blood flow, because you need to start regenerating those nerves. They will regenerate if they're still there. And I focus on other positive things. I mean, that relay race, we won first place. I was still involved in, like, Police Olympics. I went back to college. I took some college courses, which is so weird, because I took a sociology class. And in my sociology class, one of the students there was a victim and was the hostage in my shooting. So I'm sitting there in class, and the only person I was a cop. Yep. The only person in my class knew that I was a cop was my teacher. So I remember sitting there, and also we're talking about, like, racially profiling and all sorts of stuff. And it was a really interesting class. And all of a sudden in the class, something came up where this girl said, oh yeah, the guy, I was involved in that shooting on the pier. I was one of the hostages inside the arcade, and all that poor guy, he was seeing the police were shooting at him. She was going through the Stockholm syndrome. So basically she was on the suspect side. She's like, yeah, they were so mean to him. He was saying they're shooting at him, and, you know, poor guy. And I finally, the teacher looked at me, and I go, can I say something? And then everyone looks at me, and I'm like, he wasn't a good guy. I go, I was actually one of the police officers he shot. And I was lucky I didn't get killed that day. I go, he was not a good guy. He killed people, and he was wanted for murder. And I go, he ended up shooting at us first. We never shot at him. And I said, so everything you're saying, you're basically going through Stockholm syndrome, which you're, like, basically siding with him because he's making you feel like, okay, he's a good guy and so forth. And so it was very interesting. And she started crying. She gave me a hug. I started crying. We're like a mess. And everyone in the class was like going, what the heck is happening? And my teacher was like, thank you, God, like, this happened. It was like a serendipitous moment. And it was pretty amazing. But I realized at that moment in my life, I was going through so many different things, and I was helping other people in the same process. Like, whatever bad stuff I had gone through, there was always something good coming out of it. So, like, there was a book I read called Triumph Over Tragedy. And then another one that I read was Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And it's actually meant towards police officers, so they can read it, or for first responders. And it's very interesting. And it basically opened my eyes to a lot of things that we all go through. That if we stay in the negative, we're going to be negative. We're going to have toxic in our life. We're going to feel like we're hopeless and never get ahead. But if you look at the brighter light and you say, okay, what can come out of this that's positive? You know, like Adam Walsh, he lost his son, but yet look at all his stuff he's doing now to help save other kids. There's moments in your life that, as tragic as they may be at that moment, they're going to change life in more different ways in the future if you use it in the right way. So I always tell people this, whatever you're going through in life, there's a reason for it, you know, and unfortunately some of us have to suffer more than others, but there's some positive thing that's going to come out of it. So that's what I try to focus on.
You'll have to check your calendar for April 23rd through the 28th of 2023. Okay, we are having our second Street Cop conference. I can't imagine you have too much context of who we are, which is fine. I won't take offense to that. But we had our first conference this previous October of 2021. We had 1,000 cops in attendance. Uh-huh. On day two of that conference, we honored 25 to 30, maybe even a little more than 30, like 31 or 32 law enforcement officers who were significantly injured in the line of duty, some of which had never been even recognized for what they had been through. So if you would like to come to that event, I would love to have you. You'll have to fly there, but I will have a Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, nice. I'm actually going to Nashville, Tennessee at the end of this month.
Cool. Well, remember where the Gaylord is, because the resort is beautiful, and we're anticipating 1,500 to 2,000 in attendance this time.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Our keynote speakers are Rob O'Neill, who, this sounds like a shameless plug, but I'm trying to.
No, I actually met him. I actually did security for him.
Okay, yeah, so he's coming. We have, I have so much in my mind. We had a very busy morning.
Do you know Mario Oliveira?
Mario's coming to do a keynote there. He's speaking that day. So you would be there with Mario as well.
Okay.
Mario is a very good friend of Street Cop.
Yeah.
And he actually hosts our training now up in the Boston area. So Mario's
unbelievable. Yeah, he's awesome.
Good friend of ours. He'll be actually doing the presentation of the awards, him and Johnny Castro, who is the guy who does the art. You ever see Johnny Castro art? He does the paintings of all the
cops
he wanted to do.
Yes. Okay.
So Johnny's a friend of mine. He's over here in Philly. Yeah, so, Tommy Lahren will be there from Fox News. She will be there again.
Yeah.
We're friends with her. We had Sheriff David Clark.
Wait, so the 23rd to the what?
To the 28th.
Wait, when is your event? The event, the actual event?
I will let you know what day we're honoring all those people because we'd love you to be there for that.
Because
I got your ticket to the event. I got your hotel room. I'll take care of all that. You just got to fly your ass there.
Okay, I could do that.
Listen, honestly, it's a really good time and I put on one hell of a show. But I wanted you to know, it sounds like a shameless plug because I bring this up so much in the podcast, but it's really going to be a very special event. We are just very thrilled to have everybody that's coming. All right, let's get back to this. Hey, so is your mom still alive?
Yes.
How's your relationship with your mother now?
Oh, good. No, everything's great. I mean, you know, she's one of those mothers that she gets very sensitive to things and she takes things the wrong way. So, you know, I mean, I know she was going through a lot of stress during the time and it was, I can't blame her for anything. And plus, you know, she was just going through a lot. So now things are fine. Things are great. We have a good relationship.
What do you think made you so resilient? Do you think that was like your predisposition genetically or going through trauma at a young age?
Yeah, I think, I seen what my mom went through with my dad. And I mean, she had, a lot of things she went through also in her life. She's gone through a lot. Raising five of us by herself, she never asked for welfare or any kind of help from the government. She actually was breaking down walls when she was pregnant because she was remodeling the house. So she actually rented out one of the rooms to a foreign exchange student. So that's how she made money, without having to work. At one point, she actually became a security guard at night because she wanted to make some money. And then she realized she couldn't leave us at home. She had to be there for us. But she was very resilient. I mean, she was doing plumbing, electrical. So I think I take after her because she was, she had to do everything for herself. And she didn't start dating until my sister turned 18 and was out of the house. Wow. So, yeah. So she, I really look up to her and a lot of things she's done. And I think that's what made me resilient, realizing what my mom has gone through and life, just seeing how, I hear people's stories and I'm always reading. I'm always looking at, self-help books to, looking to see ways to think positive about things, to look at things differently, just try to look at things very optimistically rather than pessimistically. So,
what happened to the girl from the DUI? Did she get charged?
Yeah, she got charged, but she was from Japan. So they just basically sent her back. But her father was part owners of Honda Corporation. So I remember getting a letter from Honda saying, oh, we're so sorry, blah, blah, blah. Let us know what you need. I probably could have made millions. But because I was 2 years on the job, I wasn't thinking about suing for a lot. I thought, I just got to get back to work. Well, if I would have known now that I probably couldn't have kids because of it, or I'm now having neck and back problems from it, I probably would have sued for a lot more. I sued, I think at the time, for like $100,000. I thought I was going to get $100,000, but because work comp, they got their portion. The lawyer got his portion and I got a very small portion. So I tell people when they get injured on the job, when there's a DUI accident or some kind of accident with somebody else involved, when you sue, you make sure you sue for the amount you want to get and put above that the amount that lawyers would get and the city would get. Because if you're injured on the job, they're going to come in and they're going to get their money that they paid out to take you to the hospital, do whatever. So most people don't know that. So I basically tell them ahead of time, be ready.
What happened to the guy that shot you?
The guy who shot me, both him and the other guy got the death penalty, but in California, because of our Governor Nuisance, I call him, they're going to be pretty much in prison for the rest of their life on our tax dollar because we got rid of the death penalty.
How on God's green earth did you end up on Survivor?
That was by chance. I actually met the casting director with her ex-boyfriend and she called me out of the blue and she's like, would you like to be on Survivor? And I'm like, no, I'm good. Because I kept thinking about, of all shows, I'll be eating bugs, whatever. Like, I really didn't watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm like, no, I'm good. And she's like, no, we really need you. It was during the time they needed a female Hispanic because I was split up in races during that season. I didn't know that until I got on the show. But she was so adamant about getting me on. So next, I asked my chief, who I thought was going to say no. He goes, you know what? You can win $1 million. It's great PR. You should try it. So at that point, I'm like, okay, I guess that was my excuse to get out. Now I figured I might as well try it. So I did it and it was an interesting experience. I mean, I wish I would have read what they told me to read and watched the show because I would have known about idols and all that other stuff. But I also would have realized I probably wouldn't want to be on the show because they are very backstabbing, conniving, lying on that show. And at the time I was working in the school my last year on the job as a school resource officer. And I was talking about kids to kids about morals, values, ethics, you know, and here I'm on a show that's totally the opposite. So I knew I couldn't win the game being that way. And I was going to be the person who I am. So if I couldn't win that way, I wasn't going to win at all. So I was on there 15 days. And then I was sent to Australia because after you get voted off, you get sent away because you can't go back home yet. And that was the best experience ever. But, you know, the whole experience was amazing. I mean, I learned a lot about myself out there. It made me realize a lot of things because you had plenty of time to think. You're on a deserted island. But it was awesome. And then when I went back to school, the kids were all, they were bullies to you. They were so mean to you. And so it was actually really good connection for me and the kids. So I got along better with the kids and was able to do a lot more with them as a police officer and being on a show. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So if you ever want to be on Survivor, let me know. We're always looking for cops or retired cops.
Yeah, I'm good. You know, it's oddly enough, this may sound crazy. My friend Mike, who like washes my windows and cleans my gutters, he's a retired Hoboken fireman. He lives about 2 miles down the road from me. He just took second place in Survivor this past season.
Really?
Yeah, oh my God, funny.
I have to admit, I haven't met it because most of the time I go to a lot of the charity events or the Survivor viewing parties, but unless they're in LA, I don't see them. So unless they go to another charity we go to.
So that's interesting. What are you up to now?
Well, now I'm working for a ballistic shield company, Armor Research Company, and they're awesome. It's a 12-pound shield. They have a 10-pound and 12-pound, and they're rifle rated. So I'm basically going to police departments, going to trade shows. That's why I'm going to Nashville. Basically, I'm going to all these trade shows to make sure that these officers get in their hands and I'm able to help them. Like with the Texas situation, the school shooting, I mean, there's probably more to that. But if they would have had those shields, they would have been able to go into that classroom and help those kids. So I figured if we get these shields in every officer's hands and there are plenty of grants out there available for them that they can get them. So there's not about money. Hopefully we can get them in their hands.
You're in Santa Monica. Do you know the organization Blue Wives Matter with the Swayzes? It's blue_wives_matters on Instagram. So it's Kristen Swayze and Rob Swayze. He's actually texted me while we're talking, which is very funny because they're the only people I know in California. So they have an organization where they support the families of police officers who were killed in the line of duty. So you can follow them on Instagram. They're right near you. They come to our events. They actually bought two boots at our events. We work with them because we like their cause. And, you know, it's nonprofit. He's a retired captain out there and he's now a therapist for trauma. Oh, so you might want to reach out to him. If you DM them or I'll send you his phone number, he might be able to steer you in the right direction because he has a team of people right in your area that essentially are for law enforcement officers who have been through traumatic injury instances. So look at this, all these great things that are coming out of today.
There's a reason for everything.
You have a very endearing energy. I think people probably get very comfortable with you very quickly. You've got a very comforting feel to you. And that may sound a little weird, but
well, thank you.
Very inviting face, very inviting disposition. You ever think about going into the mental side of things as well to try to help on that side?
No, I have thought about that. I mean, I was a crisis negotiator when I was on the job. So I definitely like to do that.
Listen, this is great. I think it's making for a good episode and hopefully we have a friendship forever and try to get you to that conference. Don't be a stranger. Make sure you tell people we're friends now. I want to feel cool.
I will. I'll post it on my Facebook.
Or Instagram. Oh, shit. All right. It was a pleasure
meeting
you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Text me your number.
Okay, right, thank you. I'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.